Good evening and welcome. My name is Charles Goodhart and I have the privilege of being your chairman for this evening. I'm delighted to be able to introduce Professor Ken Rogoff, Professor of Economics and International Affairs at Princeton, who has been here this year as a visiting BP Amoco professor and also on a Guggenheim prestigious fellowship. We're very grateful to BP for making this evening possible. Now, although he is somewhat more unassuming than his confreres like Paul Krugman and Jeffrey Sachs, those who know Ken's work regard him as the more thoughtful and deeper in his analysis, and he has made path-breaking contributions in very many fields, including international debt burdens, financial crises, central banking, to name but three out of a large group. We in the economics faculty here at LSE have enormously enjoyed having him here with us in the course of this academic year, and we hope that we can this evening share some of our pleasure in having him with us, in letting you hear him give us the BP lecture on rethinking the international lending institution. Ken.
Thank you very much. I guess I'll can I use this over here?
Not sure if this, yeah, this seems turned on. I want to start by just acknowledging the London School of Economics for having me here as a visitor. This has been an incredibly exciting year, and it's a very exciting intellectual environment at LSE. I've really enjoyed it tremendously. And I'm also grateful to BP for endowing the chair the visiting chair that I hold, and to Peter Davies at BP in particular, who had me over to BP for an interesting dinner in December, where I was given the opportunity to vent some of the ideas. Not much of an opportunity. I think they let me talk for 5 minutes and then started attacking me, but I learned a lot. Anyway, it's very hard to open a business newspaper or magazine these days without confronting another sweeping idea of how to reform the quote-unquote international financial architecture. George Soros, an erstwhile graduate of LSE, has called for the formation of an international deposit insurance corporation. Jeffrey Sachs says we should have an international bankruptcy court. Paul Krugman says that economists should forget about their traditional antipathy to capital controls and that maybe they're the best option that we have today. He's actually in favor of controls on capital inflows. Another leading economist, Barry Eichengreen, is in favor of capital controls on capital inflows as opposed to outflows. The list just goes on. I'll give you a few more. Wall Street guru Henry Kaufman wants there to be a global super regulator of financial markets and institutions. Jeffrey Garton, who may be less well known to you, but he's dean of Yale Business School, thinks we should have a World Bank with a global central currency. I'm sure Britain wouldn't join, but his idea is that everyone else would. Stan Fisher, who's first deputy director of the IMF, has made the case that you don't really have to have a world money to have a world lender of last resort, and has discussed this. And many of the ideas that are being vented today are not new. They've been kicking around for a long time. But I think it's fair to say that they're being taken more seriously in official circles than has been the case in a long time. People are very desperate and don't know where to turn. And I think there's more possibility of real change in the international financial system over the next 5 to 10 years than at any time since Harry Dexter White and John Maynard Keynes masterminded the creation of the Bretton Woods sisters, that's the IMF and the World Bank, at the end of World War II. And the talk I'm giving is based on a paper that I'm writing for the Journal of Economic Perspectives, and you can look at my homepage at LSE for when it's posted. One of the sections in the paper is called "The Man Who Would Be Keynes," because there's such prestige associated with being, if you could be the one to create the international financial institution, maybe even get a part of the building named after you. And it's very George Soros could probably donate it, but it's there's a clear competition here. I don't know that I agree with George Soros, who says there's a crisis in global capitalism, but I think everybody agrees that the current system doesn't work as well as we'd like it to. If we look at what happened in Mexico in 1994, in Asia in 1997, Brazil, Russia, there's just been one global crisis after another. And these things have not been easy to predict. They've not been easy to deal with. And whereas some of the countries, I guess Russia would be a leading example, okay, maybe it's not so surprising that they fell into trouble. I think it's fair to say that people were surprised what happened to Asia. Not if you read these people's papers afterwards, but if you look at what they wrote before the Asia crisis, if you look at interest rates before the Asia crisis, people didn't expect it. Asia was growing at a phenomenal rate, and it's very disturbing and upsetting. And maybe we can't do anything about it, but it's certainly something worth thinking about. What I'd like to do today in this brief time that I have is just give you a very brief narrative of what I see the current system as, such as it is, and then go on to consider a range of plans that might improve things. Now, I'm mostly going to talk about the really ambitious sweeping plans as opposed to ones that focus on marginal changes. Why? It's more fun to talk about big things. And I also think it throws into sharper relief what the problems are, even if you're ultimately going to settle for doing something small, just a marginal change. I think some of these grand plans, even though most of them are utterly impractical, it is helpful to think about them. One twist I would like to bring to the debate is to give you a little flavor of how academic research relates to some of these issues. It is generally totally ignored in this literature. I think the view is that these issues involve so much political economy, they're so complicated, there's so many things going on that the kind of narrow issues that academics are successful in modeling can't really be too valuable. But I hope to persuade you otherwise. Well, let's start with thinking about the status quo. I think if you look at the technology-driven innovation in the global financial system, how you view it really depends on where you sit. Do you think of it as an engine of growth or an agent of destruction? If you're in the United States, I think it looks pretty good. Financial markets are the deepest and most sophisticated in the world, and I think the benefits are really obvious. In the United States, have a very low rate of savings, one of the lowest in the industrialized world, and yet the economy is growing very rapidly. And I don't think there's any doubt that a part of that is the hyper-efficient capital markets are very good at channeling savings to where it's most efficient. And I could carry this a little further, and I will, although I couldn't really substantiate what I'm going to say. But during the 1980s, you could read one book after another, Bonfire of the Vanities, Liar's Poker, about all the crazy creeps on Wall Street who were making a lot of money and not doing anyone any good. Mike Milliken's in jail. Another interpretation of what happened during the 1980s is that these very innovative financial markets, the junk bond market that Mike Milliken pioneered, helped fuel corporate restructuring that made the economy a lot more efficient. And that helped develop the boom in the 90s. That certainly, although there are glitches in what happens in the United States, some of you may know there was a very important hedge fund called Long-Term Capital Management that almost went under in August 1998. That was a little bit of embarrassment, much as I'll say a lot of people around here seem to enjoy it because a lot of the partners in long-term management were former colleagues or economists of theirs that had become very rich. That was a concern. The volatility of the stock markets is a concern. They're high, but they're certainly very volatile. But on the whole, I think the view in the United States is that financial markets are positive, and clearly Europe's moving in that direction, and not just the euro, but all the financial deregulation, everything that's going on in Europe. On the other hand, if you are a citizen of the developing world, things look very different. I think many of them rue the day when they started opening their markets to foreign capital. I think every piece of evidence you look at, and there are studies, nothing's definitive, but it certainly looks like a key ingredient of the crises that hit Mexico, that hit Asia, was they opened up their capital markets to foreign investors at a time when they hadn't really deregulated their domestic markets. They didn't have an adequate system of financial regulation, of prudential supervision, to really take this big inflow in capital, and that led to a lot of problems. Mexico had a debt crisis in 94, Asia in 97, and many of these were fueled by very mobile short-term foreign capital. I'll say more about that later. And many of these countries are experiencing extremely severe recessions that maybe might not have happened if they hadn't opened up their capital markets. I incidentally want to say I'm portraying the view of many people in developing countries. I'm not necessarily saying that I completely agree with that. Now, I want to have one little aside here to an academic note that many people have diagnosed these crises that we're seeing in the 1990s and as an example of quote-unquote multiple equilibria. And roughly speaking, the idea is that if everybody thinks your country's rock solid, money pours in, investment's great, and you do great. If everybody suddenly decides that you're not going to pay, that it's going to be a disaster, capital pulls out very quickly, and you're forced to contract at a rate which is just too sharp, too quick, and you suffer a deep depression. What the technical term that we use for it is there's a maturity mismatch. A lot of the borrowing is short term. Your projects often take 5 years, 10 years to yield a return. So if your investors aren't rolling over their loans, you can get in trouble very quickly. And we say it's a multiple equilibrium problem in the sense that if everybody, we can certainly see situations where if everybody thinks everything's going fine, you're okay. And then if people lose faith in you, you're not. And a big question is, how do you keep people's faith? And many of the proposals that I'm going to talk about today, in some sense, try to address that question. How do we keep the capital flowing? How do we prevent these panics, which are really self-fulfilling? That this is the view of many of these ideas. And one of the major ideas that I'm going to, the one that I'm going to talk about first, is having an international lender of last resort, analogous to the kind of domestic lender of last resorts that we have. Before I launch into some of the plans for doing that, I want to say that it's not exactly true that we don't have a lender of last resort of any type. In some sense, we do. The G7, that's a group of countries which is actually much larger than seven, but they call themselves the G7, basically the industrialized rich countries of the world, in concert with the IMF, effectively is a lender of last resort. That's who's bailing out Mexico, Brazil, and trying to bail out Asia. They don't have a sign up there saying, we'll bail you out if you get into trouble. But the reality of the situation is that they do. Why do they? Well, it's very complex and something that's debated a bit, but we can think of a lot of reasons. We have certainly the banking systems of the wealthy countries are very vulnerable to developing countries, more so, I think, than a lot of statistics reveal. A lot of statistics will suggest that bank lending's maybe not that important anymore the way it was in the 80s, but it's very, very misleading because of modern fancy financial engineering makes it look like they're investing in equity, but it's really just a bank loan. They're offshore derivative contracts and things like that. There's a tremendous exposure of banks. Another reason is that we get a lot of gains from trade and trading with the developing world. The gains from trade that the United States and Europe get from Asia today would have are things Marco Polo couldn't have dreamed of, that it's really quite remarkable. I might add that there's probably just a tiny bit of altruism involved and also concern over political instability in these countries. So the G7 and the IMF, in some sense, have been stepping in. But there are a lot of problems with the current system. Of course there are because the runs are still happening, the countries are running into deep recession, the system is collapsing, so there are problems. The part of the problems that they don't really have enough money, the kind of money that they're prepared to put up is nothing like what it would take to really stop these runs, and we'll talk about that later. But I think there are other problems having to do with the ad hoc nature of the whole process. Everything slapdash, decided at the last minute. Larry Summers, he's the deputy Secretary of Treasury at the United States, makes some decision at 3 a.m. in the morning on how big the package is going to be. There isn't any really clear system. And certainly, the system, quote unquote, it lacks transparency. And there's a lot of problems with perceived equity. And for example, I think many Asian leaders are justifiably very bitter about how they've been treated, the kind of loan conditions that have been put on them compared to Brazil and Mexico. Brazil and Mexico received similar size aid packages with very few strings attached. Korea, on the other hand, although on paper it was given a similar amount, it essentially hasn't been able to collect a penny because the funds are so great. Now, if you ask the G7 leaders, why are we doing that? They'll say, well, every modern central banker knows that you have to have what they call constructive ambiguity, meaning if we say what we're going to do, then you guys are all going to go out and make crazy loans and we're going to end up bailing everyone out. So we have to keep you guessing what we're going to do, and that's called constructive ambiguity. Well, if you sit in Asia, the flip of the coin, as they're being told, comes out that you have to close all your banks, all your political leaders have to go, you have to completely get rid of, you know, every leader of every corporation. I'm exaggerating a little, but not really that much. Whereas if you look at Brazil, you know, it's carnival time. We don't want a downer just before carnival time. So we're not really going to have any serious strings. And so certainly, that's an enormous problem. You can't have a stable international financial system, political system, based on something that appears so arbitrary and capricious and clearly political. What's happening in the world today after this series of crises is there's a tremendous contraction of international lending to developing countries. Part of it is simply because countries are reinstituting capital controls. Malaysia is a famous example. I'll come back to it. But the big reason is that a lot of the lenders are pulling out. The U.S. stock market is soaring. The Asian economies are diving. And if you're an investor in an industrialized country, it looks good to invest in the U.S. stock market and not in Asia. Now, there are some leading thinkers, particularly my former professor at MIT, Jagdish Bhagwati, now at Columbia, says that this is a good thing. The Asian countries, the developing countries, should never have opened their capital markets so much, that people at the U.S. Treasury, people at the IMF, were drawing an analogy between the gains from trade we get in goods, trading wheat for cars, to the gains for trade in capital. It's totally misguided, and they shouldn't have been doing that, and so good riddance, and I'm glad that we're getting rid of the system. I understand some of his concerns. I think that he's just not right, though, that you don't need international capital markets, that the gains from trade aren't similar. At a theoretical level, they're very similar to make trades in time as opposed to trades across space. They give very similar gains. And if, you know, you think about this at a practical level, you see that you can't really have a lot going on in trade and goods if you don't have capital markets. And let me take the example of suppose we send a spaceship to Mars and decide we're going to trade with the Martians. Well, you know, initially you might not need capital markets. I don't know, say Disney's building a theme park and they need Martian rocks and they fly over there. They carry copies of Monica Lewinsky's book because the Martians have been getting TV waves and they're very curious to see it. And they unload the book copies, they pick up the rocks, they come home. You didn't really need capital markets. But if you want the trade to get it all more sophisticated, you can quickly see there's a problem. Like, for example, suppose they say, well, we've already seen most of the Monica Lewinsky story, but we hear Hillary is coming out with her side in a year, but Disney needs the moon rocks now. And how do you make a trade? You can quickly see that you need some kind of international capital markets. And this is a silly example, but in fact, that's the way a lot of trade in the international economy works. Sometimes the capital markets are for a day, sometimes they're for a month, but it's very, very hard to have well-developed trade in capital markets if you don't have trade in goods markets. They're not really something that's independent. Okay, so with that introduction to the current system, let me just try to show you what some of the, a list of some of the grand plans. Probably no one can read that.
I'm not sure where the lights are here.
Is there a way to make the overhead light? Oh well, it's not that. I've experienced enough to know not to rely on transparency is when you haven't used a room before, and so I'll put away my laser pointer, which incidentally is illegal in New York City because it's too much like the light that laser-directed guns give off. I can carry a gun around, but I can't have one of these. So, but I can in London. So anyway, some of the people I have up here I've listed, Stan Fisher and Alan Meltzer, who have a lender of last resort. I have George Soros and some of the other names that I've mentioned, and I'm going to go through them in turn. I'll start with a quote from a book by Barry Eichengreen, who I mentioned. It's a very good new book on the international financial system, where he notes that he doesn't call it this man who would be Keynes contest, but that's what he's talking about. He said, there are no significant barriers to entry in the save the world financial system game, and most of the plans floating around are, quote, politically unrealistic, technically infeasible, or unlikely to yield any significant improvements in the way crises are prevented, anticipated, or managed. Now, if you're already familiar with the policy literature, you actually may think Eichengreen's being generous. But my own interpretation of the debate is that we should think about these things, that even though some of these plans aren't right, they're crazy, nevertheless, I think we learn something. And I think, especially sitting in the United States, one tends to think that they're never big institutional changes. I wrote a paper 15 years ago that the euro was crazy, it would never happen. And it does, and may have been crazy, but it did happen. So, you know, some of these things maybe might happen. So I'm going to go through a few of these ideas for saving the world financial system. And what I'd like you to keep in mind is many people's vision of the problem is this idea that a lot of the money flowing back and forth is very short-term loans, but the projects they're investing in are long-term. That's a problem that a lot of these plans are trying to address. How can you make the flows more stable and better match the projects that people have? Okay, so one idea is to have what I'm going to call a deep pockets lender of last resort. I use that term because actually lender of last resort is a term of art, and Charles has written many important papers on this. It has all kinds of different meanings. It's very fuzzy. And in fact, when people talk about a lender of last resort, they often resort to quoting Bagehot's 1873 book, Lombard Street. And it's not really because it's that clear what's in Lombard Street, but nobody's really sure what a lender of last resort is, so they have to quote something. And I'm going to call what I call a deep pockets lender of last resort, who basically comes in and says, if the borrower doesn't pay, I'll pay, so don't panic. And the idea of this is the way deposit insurance schemes work, is that if there are multiple equilibria and things are really fundamentally sound, the panic never happens and you never have to pay any money. That's the idea. Well, the IMF at the moment, if they were to use all their funds, have about $200 billion. This is about a fifth, maybe even less, as a percent of world GNP, what they had at the start of World War II. It's nothing compared to world financial markets. I'm sure you've seen these figures that $1.4 trillion a day turns over in foreign exchange markets. $200 billion is nothing. It's not going to scare off anybody, and it's not enough money. You need a lot more money. So should we have an international lender of last resort with quote-unquote deep pockets? Well, I think there's a reason, and a good one, that the G7 doesn't want to do this. And that's because there's an enormous moral hazard problem, that people will invest in very risky loans, projects they shouldn't invest in, anticipating that they're going to get bailed out. And it's already the case that the G7's constantly protesting that they'll never bail anyone out. They set aside $1 trillion for bailouts. That's not going to make these protestations more credible. I think most people think that this idea is kind of nuts. However, there are moves in this direction in the official community. There are moves to give the IMF more funding, to sharply raise its resources. They're even talking about letting the IMF borrow on international capital markets. Of the various ideas, this is one of the worst, and unfortunately, one of the ones which is most towards the front of the table on the international agenda. Another idea that's been proposed is having an international bankruptcy court. This proposal was actually first made by Rafer in 1990, but nobody noticed it until Jeff Sachs wrote a paper expanding further on the idea. You can't read my, you can't read what I have here, but the way I've written the proposals, I have Sachs' names very big and then Rafer's name in smaller font because, well, no one really noticed he did it, even though he said it first. And I actually did that with several of the proposals that, so there's the Sachs and Rafer proposal to set up an international bankruptcy court. And the idea is to give countries some breathing room in the event of one of these attacks, that to allow them to suspend payments and try to discourage the run that way. And if you can't discourage the run, to try to have a more orderly workout. For a long time, many people have expressed the concern that when an international debt run happens, there's a big grab for the assets. And if you add some way of stopping that, it would really help smooth things out. And Sachs and Rafer say that's exactly how things work in domestic bankruptcies. I think a little bit of an exaggeration, but it's better in domestic bankruptcies than it is in corporate bankruptcies. From a theoretical point of view, this is quite a reasonable idea. If you can improve the international structure, if you could have an international bankruptcy court that really had some bite, yes, it's a very good idea. Unfortunately, there are a few practical problems. One is that the analogy between a domestic bankruptcy court and an international bankruptcy court is kind of thin. An international bankruptcy court can't exactly fire the board of directors, that's the leaders of the country. They can't seize assets. They did that back in the 1800s. We don't do that. Pretty soon I'll be saying back in the 1900s, but we don't do that today. And the analogy is just not very good. Now, it's true that there are bankruptcy proceedings for cities, and Sachs and Rafer recognize that. But first of all, they don't work very well. And second of all, you seem to be able to have quite a bit more power in the case of domestic municipal bankruptcies than you can international bankruptcies. There was an outside board essentially ran New York City during the late 1970s in a way that I just don't think would be possible in any country. In fact, if you read Sachs and Rafer carefully, especially Sachs, I think what he's basically suggesting is an international bankruptcy court that would prevent lenders from making use of domestic bankruptcy courts. For example, if some country, say Brazil, defaults on its debt to Citibank, Citibank can make it quite a bit more difficult for Brazil to get trade credits, for Brazil to trade, borrow money in the United States. It has very meaningful rights in U.S. courts, perhaps some rights in Brazil courts, but definitely in U.S. courts. What Sachs has in mind is having an international bankruptcy court that supersedes these rights and is a lot nicer to debtors. Well, let's compare these two plans, because they actually capture a lot of the different ideas. One's the deep pockets lender of last resort, where we give an extra $1 trillion. And then there's the International Bankruptcy Court, where we make it a lot harder for debtors, lenders to collect their money. I mean, it's pretty clear they're going to have two different outcomes. I think if you had the Sachs Bankruptcy Court, which would lessen the few rights that lenders have now, we'd have a big contraction in lending. I don't think there's any doubt about it. If you added $1 trillion to a lender of last resort, well, probably you'd have at least another $1 trillion in lending. They'd be very different. I won't try to make a judgment between the two of which is better. Neither of them's terribly realistic, but they actually capture a lot of the different plans. Now, I'll make a second academic aside here, and this, you know, you may think is being too academic, but I actually think it's kind of important. Actually, we have no idea why countries pay their debts. We're really not sure. I know why I pay my debts, because I don't really have any choice. There's all sorts of things my creditors could do to me. But with countries, it's very unclear. And there are various theories about it. I admit to being responsible for some of them. One of the theories is that country wants to maintain its reputation. It'll pay now so it can borrow again if things get really bad. Another view is a country wants to remain in good standing in the international community, and it repays its debt as part of a broader set of international norms. And finally, there's a view, and I sort of alluded to it earlier, that creditors have some meaningful rights that allow them to harass trade and borrowing by a country that's defaulted. As long as the country stays in its shell, it's fine. But if it wants to reach out to the rest of the world and borrow money again or trade, it can run into trouble. To make a long story short, in small seminar rooms, we have heated debates over these things. There's a Bill English had a paper in the AER where he said, by gosh, Mississippi borrowed in 1877. They didn't repay. They were able to borrow again. That's proof there are no legal rights. And there's a paper by Alexander which says, no, every time countries have defaulted and debtors have gone to court, they've won. And there are all these debates about these things. Truth is, we just don't know. We're not sure. I have an opinion, but I think it's something we debate. Well, what is an international bankruptcy court going to do? If we don't know why people repay now, how on earth are we going to know what an international bankruptcy court does? If nobody's paying any attention to the domestic bankruptcy courts, they won't pay any attention to the international bankruptcy court either. If the reason people repay is to somehow conform to social norms, well, you know, maybe it would be a way of coordinating these social norms. It's only in this third instance that the legal system's really something meaningful that you'd care about an international bankruptcy court. There are quite a few of these proposals where this kind of issue arises, where you see that if you think about it a little more, we just have no idea what it would do. Or at least there's quite a bit of debate over it. Let me list a few other classes of proposals which you can't see there. One idea that's been proposed by Henry Kaufman, he's a Wall Street guru, is to have a world financial regulator, which of course would be manned by people like him, and it would oversee the banks and non-bank financial intermediaries all over the world. To make a long story short, the main objection to this is the same as to a bankruptcy court. If you don't have world political integration, it's hard to see how you could really have any bite and how this would mean anything. I'm an academic. I will mention a second academic objection. We're not so sure how great it would be to have one regulator. We're not so sure that that's really good. And there are theories about this, and again, I'm responsible for some of them. But let me try to, you know, give you the idea. I mean, right now, if your country's government puts in extremely onerous financial regulations, there are many ways to go offshore and conduct your business. If we and that's what a global financial regulator is all about, to stop you from doing that. Now, it's true, some regulations are a good thing. But if we had a global financial regulator that taxed people in an optimal way, that was benevolent in the right way, It would be nice. But there are a lot of reasons to believe it might not work like that. So the idea of having a single overarching global financial regulator, in theory, it's not obvious that that's such a good idea. It happens to be impractical, but, you know, who knows? Okay, another idea. Now we come to George Soros, has proposed having what he calls an international debt guarantee agency. And we have in the United States an institution that you have more implicit than explicit in Britain, where there's a government institution, banks pay small fees to it, and in theory, that institution will bail you out. I don't know how much money it has, maybe 20 billion. The banking system has a trillion. If you have any confidence in it, you're nuts. But anyway, it exists. And George Soros has proposed having something similar. And this institution would guarantee developing country debt. And when you had to float a bond, you would pay something towards that. And I mention again in the small print, you can't see, their former FDIC president, George Seidman, made this really very similar proposal in 1990. And in addition, Soros's proposal would have the IMF set limits on how much a country could borrow, and it would say we'd never bail out anyone else. Well, I think by now you'll see that this is dubious on a lot of grounds. First of all, if you say you're never going to bail anyone out who didn't pay their insurance, who's going to believe you? Nobody's paying any insurance now, and we bail them out. We bail them out because we care about the gains from trade, we care about our banking system, we care about political instability, we have a tiny, tiny little bit of altruism, and we bail them out. That's not changing. So creating this institution and just saying, if you don't pay your insurance, we're not going to bail you out, nobody's going to listen. Another problem is in the implementation. What would you charge? It would very hard to know what appropriate fees would be, and many people would have a problem with it. I think the Soros proposal does raise one very important point. I don't really know how to practically address it, which is that a lot of what goes on in the international financial community creates problems for other people. We are being pulled in as taxpayers to bail out banks and debtors, and they don't seem to be paying insurance premiums that are really comparable. And it would be a good idea if we could find some way of doing that, of having agents which are inflicting externalities on the rest of us have to pay for it somehow. I think a better proposal for doing this is one where we raise capital standards for banks, have them have equity holders have to put in more money that they would lose before a bailout stepped in. But it's a difficult problem. Let's see, there are just a few more I want to mention before I wrap up. There's the idea of a world money. but one thing to say about that is even if you had it, that doesn't stop debt runs. All our theories of debt runs, and if you sit in our classes and listen to our theories, a lot of them don't have money in it. It doesn't matter. You can be on a gold standard. There can still be a debt run on Korea, on Mexico. It's not going to be a currency run, but there can still be a run on their debt. Only if the World Monetary Authority were to serve as a lender of last resort, be willing to print huge amounts of money, could you even think about stopping these things. And there are lots of reasons that that's not going to work, and very similar to the ones that I've talked about before for having a deep pockets lender of last resort. And I might mention, there's also a very serious academic, theoretical question of, do you really want one currency? Is that really a good thing? And it's just not obvious. There's some benefits to having maybe not 500 currencies, but having a couple different currencies that have to compete with each other. That tempers what the providers of currency can do. And having a single world money, you want to think about it awfully hard. Some of these quote-unquote academic theoretical issues might turn out to be pretty important. Let me just hit on a couple more before I wrap up. I've really looked at all the ideas so far that have to do with creating an institution and having your name on it. There are a couple more I want to mention. All of these ideas sort of look at trying to have a lender of last resort in order to deal with this maturity mismatch, deal with these speculative attacks. There's another approach. The other approach is try to get rid of this maturity mismatch. Try to have the loans be longer so that you're not getting them pulled out so suddenly. There are two approaches to that. One is you just don't let people take their money out quickly. And another is you make it hard for short-term loans to come in. The first approach, which is we call a tax on capital outflows, Paul Krugman advocated in a very thoughtful article he posted on the web on September 30th, 1998. On October 1st, 1998, Malaysia's Prime Minister Mahathir imposed controls very similar to what Krugman was talking about. Krugman takes some credit for this, although I am told by friends I have who work in financial markets that Malaysia had been touting for a couple weeks they were going to do something big. But anyway, that's one approach. And most economists think this is horrible, and Krugman recognizes that. If you develop a reputation of eating your guests for dinner, pretty soon you're not going to have too many visitors. And countries with a track record of imposing capital exit controls are not exactly going to be at the top of investment buy lists, and nobody's going to want to go in. I will say that actually, if you go into our small seminar rooms and listen to us debate about this, it's not that obvious. It's not that obvious that unilateral suspension of payments are a bad thing. It's not that obvious in this classic diamond dividend model of bank runs and models we have of speculative, international loans. Unilateral suspension of payments are sometimes the best way for dealing with a world where we don't have a world legal authority. Sometimes that simply is the most efficient approach. There are a lot of things you can say against capital outflows, and basically I think that they are a horrible idea, but that's more of a gut feeling than anything else. Frankly, one of the reasons I think they're really a terrible idea is that they're a real invitation to corruption. If the world really condoned having taxes on capital outflows, the scope for bribing officials when huge amounts of money at stake is just tremendous. And in fact, that's one of the reasons we don't like controls on trade. Some people have advocated a control on capital inflows, and this is actually more benign. Chile has experimented with this. I'm just about run out of time. I can't say much about it, except they probably don't do much. The modern financial engineering makes it awfully easy for Citibank to go in, invest long in Chile, then offshore, write a derivative contract with the Chilean bank where it swaps its long-term payments for short-term payments, puts in suitable call provisions, and magic presto, they really have a short-term loan. But if you look at Chile's charts, it was a big success and they just have long-term loans. So it's probably pretty ineffective, but maybe not such a horrible idea. And I might further add that if it were possible to make it effective, I think a lot of developing countries would find that no one wanted to give them money. There's a reason that these loans are so short-term. Most investors don't trust the countries that they're lending to. They want to be able to get their money out in 1 month to 2 months. And if you want to get a 10-year loan, you're going to pay 100% for it. You're going to pay a gigantic premium. So these people who come in and say, oh, look, there's a maturity mismatch. I know. We'll just tax short-term capital flows. Everyone will invest long-term, and there's no problem. It goes away. It's very, very naive. They're not asking themselves the question of why are all the loans like this? And I think some of these ideas, say, of taxing short-term capital inflows run into this. I look at a couple other ideas in the paper that I'm based on. I'll skip them over, having to do with transparency, other variations of having the IMF as a lender of last resort. But let me just jump to my conclusions at this point. Basically, if you take all the grand schemes that have been proposed, there are, I would draw them into three categories. There are those that are just utterly politically infeasible unless we have a strong world government. There are plans that would lead to, if they were effective, lead to a very sharp contraction in capital flows to the developing world. You wouldn't have the runs anymore, but there wouldn't be any money either. And then there are plans where, like the trillion-dollar deep pockets lender of last resort, which would lead to a temporary trillion-dollar surge in lending, and then it would look a lot like it does today, only there'd be another $1 trillion that we'd be worrying about. I'm afraid this isn't a very sanguine assessment of what's going on, but I think it simply reflects the reality of the difficulties of trying to integrate developing countries into the global financial system. Now, if you're in my business, I'm an international economist, there are a lot of papers talking about the halcyon days of the gold standards in the 1800s, and you can see statistics that capital flows were a lot larger in the 1800s, everything was better. Well, I think the notion of sovereignty was pretty different in the 1800s than it is today. A lot of these loans were between made by European countries, either to their colonies or their former colonies. Even if they didn't directly have an army in the former colony, the implicit threat was there. It was exercised many times. So in some sense, there was something closer to a supranational legal authority. Now, if I was a developing country, I don't think I'd like this very much, not simply because it's intrusive to have the armies, but it's a very fine line between collecting debts and collecting tribute. And I think developing countries should prefer the system that we have today, that where the ethic is that you don't do that. But we have to recognize that although this greater sovereignty is a good thing, we need to think about ways for dealing with it. Now, there are some ideas that have been put forth, although they all and really do involve some loss of sovereignty. One idea that's been put forth is let foreign banks into your country. If you're a small country, let Citibank in, give up your local monopolies. Then when you have a bank crisis, it's not your banks. You don't have to bail them out, and you won't be pulled into these debt crises in the same way you are now. Another element of this is, why don't you not have your own currency? Then you can't have currency crises. The problem with this is it's not very appealing to a lot of countries. It may be that that's the only way to do it, but that involves a tremendous loss of sovereignty. You can see the United States bickering with Argentina right now. Argentina's talking about using the dollar. The United States says, fine, but don't expect us to ever, ever consider what's going on in your country when we set our monetary policy. Don't think we will ever bail you out if you need any help. Well, that system's just not going to work. And I think what the future of the international monetary system, if we really are to have something different, if we are to have something other than a sharp contraction of lending, is going to have to involve not just new global financial institutions, but new political institutions. I don't think we've seen this experience in some extent with Europe. I don't think it's realistic to ask developing countries to let in foreign banks to adopt foreign currency without having some say in what's going on. And if the future is going to move in the direction where that happens, I think that's where we need to go. So thank you, and I guess I'll take any questions this time.
Now, there should be people with mics around. Good, I see there are. If you want to ask a question, could you raise your hand and wait till somebody for the mic gets to you?
Thanks for a very valuable and informative lecture. I think we would probably agree that the present banking and financial system has got its trials and tribulations. And I'd like you to reflect upon the suggestion that effectively what we have is still a Tudor banking and financial system, following on from the legitimation of lending money for interest by Henry VIII. And you spoke of Keynes's mantle being passed on. It's worthwhile reading Keynes's very last writings, because he saw himself that deficit funding was really a very short-term solution to the post-Second World War circumstance, and looked at the two alternatives, one being Gesell's, negative interest system, where depositors pay the costs of running the system, and also the possibility of, in fact, a truly public service banking system, which you're discussing, where the community at large carries that cost and you run your banking system on an interest-free basis. Would you care to comment on these two distinct alternatives?
I'm not sure I can give an extended answer to your question, but I'll answer a different question, which is a lot of people are questioning whether we should have banks. Maybe banks seem to be at the root of all the problems. Maybe we should do something to get rid of banks. I think, on the one hand, that's just very naive. The system evolves the way it does for a good reason. There are reasons that we structure loans that way. On the other hand, I think a lot of economists, sort of smirk when they look at Islamic banking systems, which essentially everything's equity, that's the only kind of contract that's legal. And maybe we shouldn't be smirking at it.
Thank you.
Well, perhaps I could ask a question, which is that the title was Rethinking the International Financial Institutions. You didn't, in fact, produce any suggestions for how the IMF or the World Bank should be changed as institutions.
Yeah, I just didn't. I ran out of time, so I didn't. I didn't talk about that because those are fairly marginal changes. The change which is actually happening is that the IMF and the World Bank there's some push to give them much more resources. President Clinton has advocated having standby lines of credit of substantial size, moving in this direction of making the IMF what I called a deep pockets lender of last resort. I think that's a disaster. I think it's a terrible idea. The IMF doesn't have the regulatory authority, in fact, that domestic lenders of last resort have, so it can't do any prudential supervision. Introducing this money into the system may cause domestic regulatory authorities who do have power to relax and pass the mantle on to the IMF, making things worse. So the direction in which the system's moving, I don't like. There's some ideas which are being pushed, increased transparency and better financial regulation in developing countries. Well, who can object to that? It's like motherhood and apple pie. That's a great idea. But actually, increased transparency is not going to stop these runs. They're really not driven by that. In fact, in every, most of the theoretical models we have of runs, you have complete transparency. They just happen because of the maturity mismatches. In fact, we had a very interesting paper in the International Macroeconomics Workshop recently where the author made the case, actually, you're okay if it's not too transparent, but when it gets too transparent, the runs get worse. So it's hard to object to those ideas, but it's not going to solve the problem. I've heard one small idea proposed by the French government, and I find myself surprised that I would endorse a recommendation of the French government. But they've advocated having a more professional board of directors at the IMF. The executive board at the IMF is their full-time, their political appointees. They're not executive directors. They're low-level officials of their local treasuries. They can't make any important decision without getting on the phone to their treasury chiefs. And the proposal that the French made was to have the finance ministers actually meet once a month and serve as a true executive board to the IMF, making it a little less slapdash. I think that's a very interesting proposal. I mean, we need to be concerned about whether it would over-politicize the IMF. But that's an interesting idea, but it's very small in the scheme of things.
There's a question over there.
I was interested in the transparency suggestion because that did go through my mind, but I feel the same way as you. But we're trying to protect borrowers, we're trying to protect lenders. Isn't the main problem, rather simple, and I certainly can't think of a solution, that there's too much money being manipulated by too few people?
That's sort of a political agenda. I mean, none of these plans address that, none of them. I shouldn't say that. The Jeff Sachs plan does. Basically, you made the loans, let's change the system so that the poor countries don't have to repay. But if we think of it as a sustained plan,
the problems much more, if you compare it to domestic institutions, the problems much more that we don't have a world government. And internet, it's very, very hard to have highly integrated financial markets which involve these trades across time. We fly our spaceship to Mars, we pick up the moon rocks. What if we don't feel like bringing back Hillary's book? What are they going to do? And that's the problem in international capital markets.
You've been talking a bit about cures or potential cures. In thinking about those, it's helpful to think about causes. And everybody knows that the problems in East Asia are caused by corruption. One reads it again and again. But there's been corruption to the extent that there is corruption for 30 years, and there have been astonishingly high growth rates for 30 years. So what's happened to change it now? Clearly there has to be something else going on. Would you have any views on that?
I think we don't know exactly why it went on. It's very interesting to note that if you look at you look at any financial crisis that we've had in the last 50 years, whether it be in Europe, Asia, and if you were to look at interest differentials a few months prior to the crisis, if people know there's about to be a default in Thailand, Thailand should be having to pay really high interest rates. They don't. And it's just universal that maybe if you start looking a month before the crisis, people start seeing it. And so they're very hard to predict. And we can say that crony capitalism exacerbated the crisis once it hit. It showed, it revealed weaknesses in the system. I think that would be true of any system. And so, you try to deal with the problems that say you should have better banking regulation, but that's the best we can do. But it's not that easy to know why did it hit one country, why didn't it hit another, why it didn't hit Brazil and Argentina before it hit Asia, I have no idea. And in my writings, I was calling for it to hit Brazil and Argentina first.
No, there's a mic coming to you.
Would you like to comment on the heavily indebted poor countries, and particularly the Jubilee 2000 campaign to cancel debts?
A lot of debts to the very poor countries are official debts that should have been regarded as aid in the first place. And I think my own country is a disgrace in this respect, and canceling the debts, I think, is absolutely the right thing to do. What I'm talking about here is really the relations between the wealthy countries and the middle-income countries, where the middle-income countries have very cheap labor, high rates of return. You need really, really large amounts of money flowing to these countries. And how do we create a system that brokers that? I think we also would like to have flows to the poorest countries, but it's probably the case for lots of reasons that a lot of that should be aid. And I have a series of papers arguing that the World Bank should not have the word bank in its name. It should be an aid agency. It's totally misconceived for that reason, but that's another talk.
Well, there's a question over there. And that, I think, since it's after 7, will be the last question.
Thank you. You said a moment ago that you had no idea why Brazil and Argentina went before or after Thailand, whichever order it was, I forget. I should say I've just come back from living in Indonesia for 5 years, so it was very close. Surely these things are a matter of timing. Would not an economist be able to see well ahead that the debt imbalance in Indonesia, which I know best, would inevitably lead to catastrophe, that the exchange rate was inevitably going to fall, and that it was merely a matter of timing?
No, I mean, the sharpest speculators in the world did not know 2 months in advance that was going to happen, or certainly, I don't know if the date's 3 months or 2 months, and that's very clear in the data, not just in one incident, but in all of these incidences. And, of course, if I had some system for figuring that out, I would try to exploit it in some way, but then I wouldn't be here. But well, I might still be here, but it'd be the Ken Rogoff lecture,
Ken, before I thank you on the audience behalf, I've got a slightly difficult problem because I've got a note in front of me that reads as follows. There is a reception after the lecture in the senior common room. Please do not invite everyone because catering has only been booked for a limited number. Knowing the number, which I will not reveal to you, I've decided that the only way to deal with this is to invite everyone aged over 25 years old. So everyone over 25 is invited to a reception in the SCR afterwards. Everyone under 25, I'm afraid, is not. Anyhow, we've listened to a very wise, but I fear somewhat discouraging lecture, which I'm sure has made you all a lot clearer about the difficulties of moving forward in a very difficult international situation. Ken, thank you very much indeed.